What New Orleans traditions have you incorporated or have you used as a point of departure for the band?
Well, the band actually started within the New Orleans traditions, being the band was really founded to play the funerals that were around town and some of the social and pleasure club parades and picnics and softball games, that type of thing. So that is the foundation of the band, and to a great extent, we still maintain that, not necessarily by playing the funerals and parades because we're not home, but sometimes we do concerts or festivals where we do parade around the arena or something like that.
Are there musical traditions that are distinct to or unique to New Orleans that you preserve?
Yeah, in that, well, the main thing probably is the musicianship. I mean, because there are a lot of New Orleans musicians around the country, well, around the world that are doing pretty good. And New Orleans, even in rhythm and blues, has its own unique distinction. So this band still maintains or keeps as close to the brass band tradition as possible. It may seem as though we leave that tradition sometimes when we play other type tunes other than New Orleans traditional music, but we do try and stay as close to that as possible.
Are traditions handed down by older musicians in any way?
Yes and no. Not to as great an extent as they should be. I mean, there aren't that many places where a young person could go and actually learn the trade, you know, on-the-job training, so to speak. And there was even less places to play before we started. So you can, if you stay in touch with the right musician, you know, learn something. But there are not that many around who have the time and the patience to actually teach it and pass it on.
Yeah, sometimes you can think of that in two different possibilities, like somebody who keeps their cards hidden.
That's right.
Or somebody that really wants to, you know, like show you what their traditions are.
Well, that's what happened to us in the beginning. We were not getting that many opportunities as individuals to go and sit in with some of the older musicians or get gigs with some of them. So that is what got the idea of the band going. I mean, we just wanted to play. So we had worked together in other groups around the city, and we were not getting any steady work, per se, you know, only an occasional funeral, only an occasional parade. So it was like, well, we know each other, and we all know we want to play something, so let's just start rehearsing. And, you know, we got it going just for the rehearsing aspect of it.
Are there many intergenerational bands that
back home in New Orleans?
Yeah.
No, not really. Not really. The two guys in this band, Charles Joseph and Kirk Joseph, whose father is still playing today, their father influenced people like J.J. Johnson and that whole line of trombone players that came along in that era. It probably include Al Gray and some people like that. But other than that, there aren't that many continuous generations of music in this type of music at home now.
Was the senior Joseph a source of information for you when you were
there? Oh, definitely. Yeah.
What type of things did he have to say to the band?
Well, he'd come into rehearsal. We used to rehearse over at his home since the two brothers were living there, and he'd be sitting in the kitchen window or something, and he was rehearsing something. Maybe we have problem with the song, and he'd come out and tell us, you know, what they did when they were learning the song. I remember we were learning Bongo Beep. He was around when that tune came out, and he came out and said, well, you know, the trombone player would do this on that tune because maybe the runs were too fast or something like that, and the trumpet players did this and the sax, you know, and he helped out a lot. I mean, he would actually and he did encourage us to just continually just rehearse, you know, just keep it going, and something will break for you.
It's funny that you recollect something about Bongo Beep because that's a bebop tune, and you wouldn't associate that with the New Orleans tradition.
Right, right. Well, see, the thing was we were learning the traditional tunes, but we weren't getting work doing traditional music. I mean, we weren't getting much of any kind of work. So at the time I was in college at Loyola University, Roger and Charles were in at Southern University in New Orleans, and some of the other guys were studying around town. So we were learning and studying the traditional music, but we weren't getting those gigs anyway. So we said, well, we're being exposed to these other idioms, so let's just rehearse them. You know, we didn't really rehearse them with the intention of playing them on the gigs. We just were rehearsing them just to, you know, say we had done it. And then we got a gig one day, and somebody suggested that we try one of the tunes that we rehearsed. And it went over pretty good with the crowd. So we just, from the first day that we played, and it may have been Bongo Beep or Night Train, we did out on the street. And from that first day, I mean, you know, the crowd appreciated it. They liked it, and they requested it from that point on. So we just started adding from there.
It sounds like, from what you've been saying, that playing funerals is a big source of gigs in New Orleans.
Yeah. again, when we started, there were maybe two working brass bands in the city, one being Olympia and the other being Tuxedo. And those were really comprised of older guys, and they were not hiring us. Anyway, you know, so they would hire us every now and then, you know, substitute if they had too much work or something like that. So if there was a funeral or some parade and those two bands were booked up, then the funeral had no band. So then we, the word got out that there was another young band that would, you know, play a funeral. And there was a time we were doing maybe 2-3 funerals a week, and we were working, we worked 7 nights a week for about 2 years straight, you know, when we first got it started. I mean, it was just that much work to go around and not enough bands to play it. And then once we started doing it, then other bands formed around it. And now as a result, whereas there were maybe 2 working brass bands in about middle 1978, now there are about 10 working at home.
How are those jobs arranged? I mean, is that something that gigs to the funeral home, or do you know the family? Or
the family's, well, a little bit of both. Usually it's somebody's family who knows somebody in the band or knows somebody that knows a band. And there are some funeral homes who just call musicians and ask, can they get a band together for a funeral or something like that.
Is there a kind of a format, a repertoire or approach that you take to a funeral gig?
In most cases, yes, they are. The standard way of doing it is the body's coming out of the church, so there's a dirge, you know, the slow number.
What would an example of some of the tunes you'd play for that?
Old Rugged Cross or Closer Walk with Thee, something like that. And it's a slow procession to either load the body into the hearse. Some of them do a wagon pulled by mule. Sometimes the casket is carried maybe a block or so to the beat of that dirge, and then it's put into some vehicle because of time. They put it in and, you know, take a faster route to the cemetery, and then from that point on, you know, up-tempo music is played. And then maybe 2 or 3 blocks before the cemetery, or if the body's going out to the suburb or something like that, you know, they call that the cutoff. So maybe 2 or 3 blocks before that, you stop and start another dirge, or the same one, and then the body's taken through almost like a military procession. You know, the people part on both sides of the street, and body's taken on. Everybody can say their goodbyes, and it's put back into the automobile, and from that point on, it's, you know, good times. All the way back to some bar or something like that.
So the tunes change into more up-tempo?
Yes, from the time the body is cut loose, as it said at home.
Do you ever have to do that when it's raining or in bad weather?
Yeah. You know, it depends. If it's somebody who, you know, may have been dear to the band or meant something, you know, I have played funerals in the rain and stuff like that. But if it's just somebody who wanted a jazz funeral and it really, if the weather's bad, you know, it breaks it up.
Is that a mark of any type of a status or affluence or anything like that? Does it indicate anything in New Orleans?
In the past, it had probably been reserved just for jazz musicians or people associated with music. But nowadays, it's usually some club member, social pleasure club member, something like that, or a musician. Or if it's just somebody who wants to hire a band for a funeral. So you don't have to necessarily belong to some organization to have a jazz funeral.
I suppose playing a funeral for somebody that you knew or you were close to, that the music would have kind of a special quality. You know, the whole gig would have a special quality.
Oh, yeah. Well, usually if it's some musician that has died and you're playing that funeral, most times there is no money involved. The musicians just volunteer to play the funeral.
Do you ever get special requests or do you select numbers that you know was in memory of the departed?
Not necessarily, unless it was something special to that person. But other than that, you're pretty much on your own.
It sounds like there's a pretty hefty musical establishment in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's just like anywhere else. You know, if you're not in the clique, so to speak, you don't work. So, and I would imagine that in the beginning, we represented some type of threat to some of those older guys, which is understandable. I mean, it wasn't that much work to go around anyway. So they may have been an effort to keep us out, because that may have taken some jobs away from some people. But we have no hard feelings about it. I mean, we're not trying to get those jobs anyway, down on Bourbon Street. That's about the only steady work for musicians or for bands in New Orleans, other than a few clubs scattered around the suburbs. But other than that, there's not that much music, steady work for musicians in New Orleans.
Is the music on Bourbon Street, is that really oriented towards tourism?
That's all. I mean, if you can ask musicians, other musicians who've been to New Orleans, and even the musicians who are down there on Bourbon Street, they don't necessarily want to be playing that because they're only restricted. They are restricted to what the club owners want, and the club owners only want what they think the tourists want. And so it seems like it's a merry-go-round, and the tourists end up being, for the most part, disappointed because it's not what they thought it would be. And the club owners are making music decisions about something that they know nothing about.
Can you describe what that music would be? I mean, I've never been down on Bourbon Street.
Well, you have people. All right, the Dirty Dozen has a makeup basically of a traditional band, but we are not a true traditional band. So on Bourbon Street, you have people attempting to play traditional music who are only doing it for a gig, and they may not have ever done that in their life, even studied traditional music. So you have people down there faking it, trying to play something that they really not familiar with.
What does that mean in terms of the tunes and also in terms of the stage presence? And, are the bands expected to mug or to dress in any way?
That's correct, and which I personally don't like. I mean, they're trying to make the musicians, black and white, maintain an image of what was, 40 or 50 years ago, and they're trying to put them in the mold with how Louis Armstrong did his act, or King Oliver and those guys did their act, and times have changed since then. And you have these club owners making these decisions, and they don't know how times were back then. So they figure this is how the tourists want it, and this is what they want to see. So they have guys put on these funny hats and, these funny shoes and nobody wants that. I mean, believe me, when tourists come down, they'll walk by the clubs, if they see it's just some sideshow.
Do the musicians that play those gigs, do you think they resent that?
They do. Yeah. But, what can they do? Some of them are old guys, and some of them, it's really a situation. It's a dilemma because you got the old guys who maybe won't get work. This is the end of the line for them. I mean, I'm 50 years old. Where else am I going to go? I'm not going back on the road. And you have a young guy who has a chance to make some money. That's what they need, some money. So, you got those two forces pulling against it. And, what can you do? They can't do anything.
How about Mardi Gras? I mean, is that a fun time, or do you just, dread the idea of all the tourists coming into town?
Well, it's to the point, this will probably be our first Mardi Gras not working. I mean, by choice, we're not going to work this Mardi Gras. And it's not that we dread the the tourists and all that. I mean, it's a fun time and all, but we just want to be off. Most musicians, if they had a choice, would probably not play as long on Mardi Gras. You know, Mardi Gras, you got to work long hours. But it's you end up having a lot of fun doing it, but the day after, it's when it tells on you. But for the most part, you know, there's a lot of work to go around for musicians around Mardi Gras. They have a good time doing it, so they do it.
Why did you pick trumpet as your instrument?
I tell you, my first choice was drums. But when I showed up for class, there were about 60 other people who also wanted to play drums. So then there were maybe about 4 drums in the class, you know. So it was, well, we only have 4 drums, so what else do you want to play? So my second choice was French horn. But then after I saw the big case that I would have to carry home each evening on the bus, I said, forget it. And so the next day I showed up for class, there were new trumpets. The school got new trumpets. So I picked trumpet.
I think a lot of people end up choosing their instrument and their life's work by what might have been available in the school orchestra.
Yeah, that is what happened to me and some other people, you know, that I went to school with. I know they ended up playing their second or third choice. So.
Well, I'd imagine that anybody growing up in New Orleans, especially if they're playing trumpet, just has to be really influenced by the New Orleans traditions of, like, by Louis Armstrong.
Oh, definitely. Well, that was my the first recollection that I have of knowing anybody that played trumpet was Louis Armstrong. And then I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. The first other trumpet player that I had ever listened to was Dizzy Gillespie after I had heard of Louis Armstrong. So, but there's a lot of music happening in New Orleans. I mean, you have to play more than just jazz to really earn any money in New Orleans, because there's still a lot of rhythm and blues gigs, and there are a lot of church gigs, and then the funeral, you know, the traditional gigs. So you can really learn your trade just by hanging in New Orleans, because you have to play more than one type of music.
And also, well, just thinking about the type of playing that you do and the different types of tunes with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, I would think it's nice that you have the chance to play in different styles. You're really reflecting different eras of jazz trumpet playing.
Uh-huh. Well, the thing is, we got 8 people in the band, and probably no 2 people listen to the same musicians. You know, I still listen to a lot of Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong and Freddie Hubbard and that type of stuff. And the other trumpet player, I'm not sure who he listened to, but a lot of times when we're playing tapes on the road, you know, he has different stuff from what I have. So I know he's listening to other people. The tuba player is more into the Weather Report fusion type stuff. So is one of the tenor player, the tenor saxophone player. The baritone players into Charlie Parker and Charles Mingus and Sonny Stitt and that type of stuff.
Yeah, you can tell that from the playing.
Yeah. So, you know, everybody's into something different. So we have to also make a compromise in the music that we play, because we have to satisfy 8 people. You know, I'm perceived many times as being the leader of the band, but that's only so because I take care of the money. I make sure everybody gets paid. I make sure that we get paid and we get the tickets and that. But there is not necessarily a leader per se standing up saying, okay, we're going to play this. This is what we're doing. So we don't necessarily have one style of music that we play. I mean, everybody has some input into what's going to go on.
The band's recently performed with Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah, and that was good.
How'd you hook up with him?
Well, he had we first met in New Orleans. We were doing the Cool Festival, and we went on just before he did, as a matter of fact. And he was behind stage when we were playing. And somebody brought him out 2 weeks before the gig. Somebody from the Jazz Festival office brought him down to the Glass House where we were playing, and he hung out to about 3 in the morning. So then he showed up at the Cool Festival, and he was standing behind stage just playing around while we were on stage. And then we met again.
He didn't walk up on stage?
No, he didn't come on, no.
In the middle of your...
No. And then when we were in Italy in 1984, and Nice and some other cities, he was just backstage, and, you know, he showed an interest in the band. And so I had been bugging people down at the Jazz Fest. I said, look, why don't you book us on the show with one of these other great musicians playing along with the band instead of us doing a set and they do a set. So when we came back from our winter European tour, they told me they had booked a show with Dizzy Gillespie on it. So when he came in, we did a whole lot of stuff in rehearsal, a lot of which we didn't get a chance to do on stage because of the time. But that was good. That was a learning experience.
Now, did he rehearse the band, so to speak?
No.
He wasn't leading the
rehearsal? No. He came in, I tell you, he came in and just asked, what do y'all want to play? Whatever y'all want to play, I'll play. And so we put together a list of tunes to play, and he was at the rehearsal, and we started playing tunes. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to play this. Or, look, why don't, you know, there were some things, some changes in some tunes that he wanted to do because that's how he liked to do them, which was good because it opened our eyes to something else.
Okay, can you share an example, I mean, to non-musicians of like, what his, how you would have changed your approach to work with what his ideas were?
Well, when we did Caravan, we do it basically like it is on the album. So we did the intro, and we were used to just playing the solos coming in after the bridge. Okay, he wanted to come in, swap the solos on the bridge, which was good. But that was good, and it made us have to think about coming in playing on a different set of chord changes.
Right.
So we ran that down a couple of times. Then he did, you know, he's into singing stuff and all that on stage. So we were doing blues numbers with a single break, you know, like, bump, 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 I went down to the phone, bump, down. But he did it with double breaks where he would actually do the vocal work twice the amount of time that it was supposed to be, which
like
is...
What? Yeah, how would that...
Well, I mean, it would be like, bump, 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 I went down to the dun-dun, and I saw my baby there, bump, bump. You know, he just extended the break a little longer, and, you know, we were aware of that, but we hadn't been doing that. So we spent a little time on that. Then we did a blues. He wanted to do a real up-tempo blues because he likes to scat some, and we spent about maybe 30 minutes on rearranging the blues. He didn't want the bass to walk. He just wanted the bass player to play the root of each of the chords. So at first we thought, damn, this might leave the tune empty, but it worked out.
It's a more funk type of a...
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we thought it was going to be... He wanted an up-tempo blues, but we thought it was going to be a walking bass line through the whole thing, you know, doom, 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 doom. But he just wanted doom, 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 doom. You know, and that worked out.
You have a new record coming. It's about to come out. What excites you about the upcoming album?
Well, in that it has allowed us to just about complete the material that got us some national recognition. We wanted to get as much of that stuff down as possible.
Like what?
We had actually two arrangements on Blue Monk. We had some other original tunes that we had been doing. So it allowed us to get the, you know, stuff that we had been playing for a long time, maybe too long, but it allowed us to get it on wax, and now we can finally, you know, really depart and continue on. Because if you do a tune for a long time and then you leave it alone for a while, you may not come back to that tune the same way. So we had to really keep those tunes going until we got them down. Because we wanted to get them down as close to what we were doing when people started recognizing the band. So that second album allowed us to do that, and it's live, which I think the band comes off better live.
Well, good luck with the band. I really enjoy it and looking forward to the new record.
All right.
It's been good talking with you.
Okay, thank you.